few years ago, a friend of mine who had for many years professed to know and love the Lord Jesus walked away from his family, from his friends, and from his God. For years he had said that he believed certain things about the future, but then he said he no longer believed those things. Circumstances of life confronted him, and he decided that what he all along had said he believed could not accommodate those new circumstances in his life, and so he changed what he believed. Last week I mentioned a man who went to church all of his life, that is, until his 2-year-old child died, and since that day he has not darkened the door of a church. Now, like my friend, this man's picture of the future must have changed. What he thought was going to happen in the future, that is, what he thought before was going to happen in the future, he no longer believed would happen. As I said last week, what you believe determines what you do. What you believe determines what you do. I mentioned that last week, but today I'd like to consider that in a slightly different context. How many people get a dose of Christianity saying they believe it, and then somewhere along the line they drop out? When they accept Christianity, they accept it by getting a certain picture of the future. They get a certain mental picture of what the future is going to be like, and then when it doesn't turn out quite that way, or they stop believing it will turn out that way, they quit the whole thing. I think there is tremendous temptation to bail out of Christianity. How many times have you prayed, I mean even pleaded with God to change something that was truly important to you, and it does not appear as though God even heard, much less responded? In spite of your best efforts at doing things right, you lost your job, you couldn't find another one, or your spouse walked out on you, or your business collapsed, or something happened to your kids, and you looked around in the midst of all of that, and you looked at some of the most outrageous pagans getting along just fine. The godless and the ungodly seem to prosper, and often it seems they are having much more fun in life than those who obey the God of the Bible. Christians are expected to forgive and turn the other cheek when they are offended and abused. Christians are expected to pursue life not for their own advantage, but for the advantage of others. Christians are expected to think of all of their money as belonging to God, and how they save it and spend it and invest it and give it away is to be determined by God. Christians are expected to invest a significant part of their time in helping others, not just in recreating and vacationing. Christians are expected to be together with other Christians in church weekly and at other times for the purpose of encouraging those other Christians and worshiping God. Do you have any idea, and I think many of you do, how much all of those expectations interfere with life? Why not just forget it? Why not just walk away from Christianity? Would you please look in your Bible at Hebrews chapter 10, verse 32. This letter we call the Hebrews was written to a church somewhere in the Roman Empire, probably a church in the city of Rome, or at least nearby the city of Rome. Rome, as you probably recall from your history, was a city and an empire that was not overly sympathetic to Christianity. To the contrary, Christianity was considered a threat to the Roman Empire, and threats in those days were not handled in courts that respected civil rights and freedom of religion. In AD 49, Emperor Claudius expelled the Christians and the Jews from the city of Rome. Seen as enemies of the people, those Christians were subjected to insult, persecution, and the confiscation of their property, not unlike what we saw before World War II in what was called Kristallnacht in Germany. And the people got out of the area only with what they could carry on their own backs. Now, at the time of the writing of this letter, it's about 15 years later, that is, 15 years after that first incident. And under a new emperor, a new threat breaks out against the Christians. A fire has started in Rome, It spread quickly throughout the city. Once it was nearly contained, and then it broke loose again, and it raged until it had devastated 10 of the 14 districts of the city, totally destroying 3 of them. The very unpopular Emperor Nero had been away when the fire broke out, and he returned to the city when his own palace was threatened. He provided emergency assistance. He made certain that offerings were offered to the gods to somehow appease them, and he embarked on an elaborate program of urban renewal. Now, the problem for the emperor was that there were those people who believed that he was simply doing all of that as an attempt to cover up the fact that he had deliberately started the fire. Now, to silence those rumors about him, Nero commanded the imperial police to move against the Christians. A contemporary Roman historian wrote that Nero did this to suppress the rumors about him. And so he fabricated these scapegoats, and using every punishment imaginable against these, as they called them, depraved Christians, Nero attempted to avert the blame, or at least the unpopularity. So these Christians were paraded before the city magistrates, and they were condemned to death for arson. And on the basis of their testimonies, many other Christians were discovered, and likewise they were tortured, and many of them put to death. That is the time when the Christians moved into the catacombs that we now see in the city of Rome, and they scratched out from the sandstone places for them to dwell and to hide from the Roman authorities. What would it have been like to have been at that time part of a church in Rome, or to have been part of a church even in a city near Rome? The stories were too awful. The threat was too close. What price were these people willing to pay to be disciples, to be followers of Jesus Christ? They had reason for quitting Christianity. Listen to the author's words, beginning at verse 32 of chapter 10. Remember, the author writes, those earlier days after you had received the light, that is, after you had become Christians. Remember when you stood your ground in a great contest in the face of suffering. Sometimes you were publicly exposed to insult and persecution. At other times you stood side by side with those who were so treated. You sympathized with those in prison, that is, those imprisoned because of being Christian, and joyfully accepted the confiscation of your property because you knew that you yourselves had better and lasting possessions. So do not throw away your confidence. It will be richly rewarded. You need to persevere so that when you have done the will of God, you will receive what He has promised. Let me stop there and ask a question which I think could have come to their minds even as they read these words. But how do you do that? How do you persevere in the face of such persecution? How do you persevere in the midst of circumstances that seem to have no solution? What keeps Christians from bailing out? What keeps you from quitting when things seem unbearable? And the one word answer given to us in this text is the word faith. Faith. Now, wait a minute. Please do not jump to conclusions about what I mean by that word faith. I always fear when I use a well-known theological word when I'm preaching because I think that people tend to kind of fuzzy up those words. And that is, the definition is very cloudy. Faith is one of those words that we hear so often, we don't even any longer put any definition to it. We just say, oh, yes, faith. The answer to how do Christians keep from bailing out is the concept of faith. But what is this word faith? Listen to the Bible beginning at verse 37. Now the author here, beginning at 37, is quoting from the Old Testament, and he tells his readers how they can persevere, how they can remain faithful to God even in the midst of great persecution. Verse 37, for in just a very little while, the author goes on, he who is coming will come and will not delay, but my righteous one will live by faith. There's that word. That's the answer. How do you persevere? The answer is faith. But what does it mean? And we've already seen the word faith used in this letter in one way. Faith, as we saw earlier in the book of Hebrews, means believing that God will forgive us and bring us into His family if we trust only in Jesus Christ and in His death and resurrection for us. When we speak of faith, of that kind of faith, or speak of faith that way, we are talking about the faith that is used in the line, we are saved by God's grace through faith. That is, faith in the finished work of Jesus Christ. But the faith spoken of here in Hebrews chapter 10 is not the faith that looks back. Not the faith that looks back to trusting in Jesus' finished work on the cross for us, for our forgiveness and new life. But the faith that is spoken of here is the kind of faith that looks forward. In fact, the author gives his own definition of this faith in the first verse of the next chapter. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 1. Now faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. I think most of you remember that Hebrews chapter 11 is called the great faith chapter in the Bible. And if you will look right now down through that chapter, you will see that verse after verse begins with, by faith, someone or another did such and such. Now, obviously, what the author is doing is illustrating illustration after illustration of the point that he is trying to make. And what's the point? How do you remain faithful to God even when everything appears to be going wrong? And the answer again is faith. Now, before we look at the illustrations, however, I want us to once again look at this definition of faith so that it's very clear, very sharp in our minds. From verse 1, we learn that the faith that the author is describing has two components. I want you to look at the text, please. I want you to find them with me. The two lines of verse 1. Again, I read it. Now, faith is being sure of what we hope for, line 1, and certain of what we do not see, line 2. What are the two things that you see in both lines? That is, what are the two components of faith that the author is describing? What words do you find in line 1 that you find synonyms for in line 2? Looking at it with me, please. In line 1, first of all, I think you will see some words, I'm not sure of your translation, some words that go something like this: being sure, being certain, being assured, being confident, something like that in line 1. Compare that then to line 2. What words do you find in line 2 that are similar to it? In the New International Version, it's the word certain. In line 1, being sure. In line 2, certain. What's the component? Certainty, confidence. Look again at line 1. Toward the end of line 1, you will see the words, what we hope for. Compare that, please, to line 2. What do you find as a synonym in line 2? What we do not see is the parallel in line 2. And what's the component? That is, what are those ideas referring to? They're referring to vision. What you see with your mind's eye in the future. What you hope for. What you cannot see with your physical eyes, but what with the mind's eye you can see. The two components of faith are certainty and vision. Please look with me at chapter 11, verse 6, where the author gives us even more help in understanding what he means by faith. Without faith, he writes, it is impossible to please God, because anyone who comes to God must believe that God exists and that God rewards those who earnestly seek Him. In that verse, what's another word for the word we have already seen in verse 1 that we summarized as the word certainty? What's the word in verse 6 that would be a synonym? It's the word believe. You believe. You're certain. What's another word for vision that we saw in verse 1? What's another word for it or another phrase for it in verse 6? Now, this might not be quite as obvious to you until you study it for a little while, but look, please, at the words, God rewards those who earnestly seek Him. When are rewards given? In the past or in the future? The future, of course. The issue is that faith looks forward to the rewards that will come. We have a synonym here for this word vision. It's a looking forward to. I'm ready now to give a definition for faith. Faith is the act of believing God and mentally seeing His vision of the future, even when we can't see it with our physical eyes. Faith is believing God and mentally seeing His vision of the future, even when we can't see it with our physical eyes. Or as the Bible says it, faith is being sure of what we hope for, being certain of what we do not see. And he who comes to God must believe that God exists and that He will reward those who earnestly seek Him. Because of God, we are certain of Him, and we are certain of His vision of the future. I want you now to look with me at chapter 11 and see the illustrations the author uses to drive home his point. But again, what's the point? By faith, we are able to remain true to God even when circumstances tempt us to quit. By faith, we may remain true to God even when everything around us would point us in the direction of bailing out on being a Christian. Now, when we look at the 11th chapter, we see that the author gives illustrations from one end of the Old Testament to the other. I don't know if you've ever noticed that before, but I hope you will now if you haven't. It starts in verse 3, where he references creation. By faith, he says, then he refers to creation. He goes next in verse 4 to Abel. You recall that he was one of the children of Adam and Eve. Verse 5, he goes next to Enoch, who's a descendant of Adam and Eve. Verse 7, he moves to Noah and the issue of the flood. Verses 8 through 19, he deals with Abraham, obviously a descendant of Noah. Verse 20, we see Isaac, the son of Abraham. Verse 21, we see Jacob, the son of Isaac. Verse 22, Joseph, the son of Jacob. Verses 23 to 29, we come to Moses, one of the descendants of Jacob. Now they're in Egypt. Verses 30 and 31, he mentions the time of Joshua, who took over from Moses as the leader. And then at verse 32, he realizes that it would take far too long for him to give as much attention to all the rest of the people he can think of. And so he simply summarizes all of it by mentioning the time of the judges, which came after Joshua, and the time of the kings, and the time of the prophets, telling how some of them were victorious in life and others of them were thoroughly defeated in life, but all of them, verse 39, were men and women of faith. Now, do you see it? All the way from creation, verse 3, all the way to verse 38. A panoramic sweep of the history of the Old Testament, many of the men and women of it. And what do we learn from all of these illustrations that help us remain faithful when the temptation is to quit? The first thing I want you to see about the faith of these people that instructs our faith is that faith sees the invisible. Faith sees the invisible. Look, please, at verse 7. It says, by faith Noah, when warned about things not yet seen, in holy fear, built an ark to save his family. I think most of you are sufficiently familiar with the incident to remember that God is the one who came to Noah and told Noah what was going to happen. That is, a flood was coming. Noah had a choice. Noah could believe God's picture of the future, or he could believe the picture of the future that you would draw from immediate circumstances and what you knew of history. He had a choice of pictures to believe. When warned about the things not yet seen, the text says, Noah got the vision. Noah got the picture in his own head that God had, and Noah acted on the basis of that picture. The picture of what would be was more real to Noah than anything else that he could see with his physical eyes. In spite of the fact that he lived in a landlocked country, in spite of the fact that there likely had never even been rain, much less a flood before, Noah built the ark. By faith, he saw the future, and he acted on it. By faith, he saw the invisible. Look at the last part of verse 8. God told Abraham to leave his home city of Ur, and it says, Abraham obeyed God even though he did not know where he was going. Now, God told Abraham that God was going to make of Abraham a great nation. God told Abraham that he was going to give him a land of his own, an inheritance of a great land. Stuart Babbage is an Australian pastor, and he has four pictures hanging on the wall of his study. Each of the pictures is nearly identical and equally barren desert. When he was asked why he hung those pictures on the walls of his office, he said that he took those pictures while he was standing in the ruins of ancient Ur, where Abraham had lived. And no matter which way you looked from those ruins, you saw the same thing, sand. Why would Abraham leave that cultured, comfortable, and secure city, not even knowing where he was going? It's because Abraham believed the picture of the future that God gave him, even though that picture contradicted everything he could see around him. Faith sees the invisible. Look at verse 22. Speaking of Joseph, who lived in Egypt and died 300 years, catch this, Joseph who died 300 years before his descendants left Egypt. The text says correctly that Joseph spoke about the exodus of the Israelites from Egypt and gave instructions about his bones. That is, Joseph had a picture, a God-given picture handed down to him from his father, his grandfather, his great-grandfather. He had a picture of the future that the people of Israel, that is the descendants of Jacob, would live in a land of their own, the land of Canaan. And with that picture in his mind, even though he was in Egypt, in spite of all of the evidence around him, with that picture in his mind, believing God, Joseph saw the invisible and acted on it. Now, there are at least five more examples of this among these illustrations. Five examples, five more at least, of the same idea. What kept these people going? What kept them going was their God-given picture of the future. And that picture was more real to them, and they believed it more firmly than anything they could see in the present. My question is, what picture of the future do you have? What picture of the future do you have, and what impact does that picture of the future have on the way you live? What do you know is going to happen in the future, and how does that affect the way you live today and the choices you make? Faith is seeing the invisible. The second thing I want you to see about the faith of these people that instructs our faith is that faith overcomes fear. Faith overcomes fear. Look with me, please, at verse 23. It says, "By faith, Moses' parents hid him for 3 months after he was born because they saw he was no ordinary child and they were not afraid of the king's edicts." Now, most of you probably also remember that the Egyptian leader, fearful of the population explosion of the Israelites in his country, ordered that all of the male children should be killed. Moses' parents, however, according to this text, and we know it from the Exodus passage as well, Moses' parents did not comply. Why? Why would they dare do something contrary to the power of the Pharaoh of the land? Look at the middle of the verse. It says they saw something. They saw he was no ordinary child. Now, to me, it's obvious. It does not mean that they picked up this baby and he looked unusual to them. I'm convinced of what it means, that they had eyes of faith and those parents saw into the future. They understood the promise that God had given to their people. They saw into the future and they obeyed God, and their faith was stronger than their fear of the Pharaoh. Look at verse 27. "By faith, Moses left Egypt, not fearing the king's anger." When the Israelites finally left Egypt after the night when all of the firstborn children of the Egyptians were slain, the king, that is the Pharaoh, changed his mind. And once again, the Pharaoh sent his army to stop the people from leaving Egypt. Now, I want you in your mind to get a picture of well over 1 million people, probably 2 to 3 million people, men, women, and children, ox carts, oxen, sheep, cattle, all of their household furnishings, everything they could possibly carry, and this incredible caravan of people bogged down, if you will, by all of their goods. And then the Pharaoh of, at that time, the greatest country in the world, with the mightiest army in the world, sends his army to stop those people. But the text says Moses left anyway. Why? Look at the rest of the verse. "He persevered because he saw him who is invisible." Moses saw something. In Moses' mind's eye, he saw the future, and the picture of the future that he saw, he believed even more than he naturally feared the Pharaoh. That's how strong, that's how clear, that's how sharp that picture of the future was in his mind. When Martin Luther was fighting for his life, literally in many cases, during the Reformation in Germany over 400 years ago, he writes that at night he would go to the window of his room and he would look out and he would ask God, "Whose world is this anyway? Is this your world, God, or is it mine? I know it's your world, God, and so I'm going to bed. I'll see you in the morning." In spite of the opposition, in spite of the what naturally would have been fear for all of his enemies, his confidence in God and his confidence in God's picture of the future overcame his fear. The third thing I want you to see about the faith of these people that instructs our faith is that faith overcomes temptation. Look with me, please, at verses 25 and 26. I read, "Moses chose to be mistreated along with the people of God rather than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a short time. He regarded disgrace for the sake of Christ as of greater value than the treasures of Egypt." Again, I suspect that many of you remember that Moses, though a Jew, was raised in the palace of the Pharaoh's daughter. But when it came time to choose between living as the grandson of the Pharaoh or living with God's people, he chose living with God's people. Why? It's that vision thing again, as our former president George Bush put it one time. It's that vision thing. Moses had a picture of the future that God had given to him and to his people, and he believed God, and he believed that picture. And our text says that he regarded that future as yet unseen. He regarded that picture of the future with such certainty that he valued it higher than all of the treasures of Egypt. Now, I wish we had time to stop and think about the incredible faith that that represents. I don't know how many of us could stand up to that kind of temptation. Everything imaginable for a man to have. And yet the picture of the future was more real to him, had greater power to him than all of the wealth of Egypt. Everything in this culture vies for our attention as well. Everything in this culture vies for our investment. The temptation to invest in the here and now, the temptation for us to succumb to the pleasures of the moment are intense in this culture. But as Moses, so we should have a vision of a future that is so absolutely clear. And it was in that future that Moses was going to invest. It was in that picture of the future that he would invest everything. What about you? What God-given picture of the future do you have, and are you investing in that future? Or is your greater investment elsewhere? Faith overcomes temptation. The fourth thing that I want you to learn about faith, about from the faith of these people, is that faith overcomes delay, and faith overcomes opposition. Faith overcomes opposition. Look at verse 21. Jacob was the grandson of Abraham. To Abraham, years earlier, had been given the promise of becoming a nation of many people who would have a land of their own. That promise had been given to Abraham. It had been reiterated to Isaac and then to Jacob himself. But now here's Jacob, many years later. He's an old man. He's not even in the country, the land, that is, that had been promised to the people of Jacob. He's in a foreign country. My expectation is that the vision would have surely faded by that time. After that much time, and still it hadn't come to pass, maybe they misunderstood God. Or maybe God wasn't going to do it after all. But what does the verse say, verse 21? Jacob, remember, he's living in Egypt now. He's an old man about to die. And he blessed Joseph's sons, and he worshiped God. From the Genesis account, we learn that Jacob spoke to Joseph and his sons about the part of the land that was going to be theirs when they left Egypt and went to Canaan. All these years later, and Jacob still didn't miss a beat. He still believed God. He still had the picture of the future that God had given them, and he acted on that picture as if it had already happened, and he worshiped God. Faith overcomes delay. But it also overcomes opposition. Look at verses 36 to 37. You'll have to read it. I'm not going to take the time to. But the author recalls that down through the years, many had met such opposition to their faith that they had died. And he talks about the terrible kinds of circumstances under which they died. But they died with their vision undimmed. Even death could not conquer their vision. Richard Wurmbrand is a man who for many years worked to get the scriptures and the gospel to people behind what was once the Iron Curtain into once communist-controlled countries. But before he began that ministry, Wurmbrand was imprisoned in his own country because of his Christianity. He was a part of a network of what are called underground churches. And he, along with many others, were arrested. And for 14 years, that man lived in a soundless cell 30 feet below the ground. He saw no trees, no sky, no children. He reports that he was hungry all of the time. They were fed potato peel soup and sometimes only a slice of bread a week. And for 14 years, they tried every inhumane form of torture they could think of to get him to tell about the other churches and the other people and to renounce his faith. But he did not renounce it. Richard Wurmbrand did not renounce it because his God-given picture of the future, that picture that he carried in his head, was clearer and more real to him than even the circumstances under which he lived. Faith overcomes even opposition because the vision is so clear as to what the future is. There's so much more in this chapter, but the last thing I want you to learn about faith from the faith of these people is that faith has an object. Faith has an object. Many people today define faith as that silly belief that something will happen that can't possibly happen. Faith is defined as that which you fall back on when you have no reason to believe, when there's no evidence. Faith is defined as kind of an irrational optimism. But not according to the Bible. The faith of the Bible has an object. For faith to be biblical faith, faith must believe in something, and it must believe in someone. It is not irrational optimism. Faith, according to the Bible, is belief in something and in someone. I've already described faith as having two components, certainty and vision. Vision is about the pictures of the future. What God-given picture did Noah have in his head? I want you to imagine it. What God-given picture did Noah have in his head? He had a picture of an earth that was covered by water. He also had a picture of a boat floating on that water in which he and his family were safe. And why was he so certain that that picture reflected reality, future reality? Because he believed God. You hear it? Noah's faith had an object. The object of his faith was the picture that God had given him about the future. The object of his faith was the God who promised it. What was Abraham's picture of the future? Abraham, in his mind's eye, saw a country. He saw a land. I'm sure he could imagine trees and he could imagine an oasis here and there. I'm certain he could imagine hills and valleys, mountains. He saw a land. And he also saw that land populated by thousands, even millions, of his own descendants. He believed God. That picture had not yet come to pass, but he believed God. It was going to come to pass. Faith has an object, a God-given faith, vision, picture of the future, and of the God who promises it. If you don't have a faith vision of the future, I cannot imagine how you can withstand the pressures of life. If you do not have a vision picture, a God-given vision picture of the future, I can't imagine how you can deal with the pressures that come in life. Without that picture of the future, with that God-given picture, life will throw you. God says, I don't want you to shrink back. I don't want you to fall away. I don't want you to throw away your confidence. I don't want you to bail out. The question then is, what God-given picture of the future do you have? And do you live by that picture? Do you believe God? Let me tell you, just in closing, what I see in that picture of the future that is given to us by God in His Word. What is that picture of the future that God in His Word guarantees? And I dare believe God. And that picture of the future, I believe that it will come to pass, even though I don't presently see it. First of all, I see a people of God grown to maturity in Jesus Christ. That is, I see a congregation of men and women. This congregation. I see a congregation of men and women who love the Lord Jesus, who love His people, and who love to do His will. I see a congregation of people who delight in coming into the presence of God with one another. And it makes a difference, a tremendous difference in their lives. That's the picture I have. We're not there yet. That's the picture I have. Do you know why I have that picture? Because God in Philippians chapter 1, verse 6, and corroborated many other places, says, I am confident of this, that He who began a good work in you will carry it to completion until the day of Christ Jesus. That's the picture God painted of this congregation. And I believe it. And if I cooperate with God in the coming to pass of that picture, that vision, I cannot fail. God has guaranteed it will happen. I'm willing to invest my life to see it happen. How about you? Secondly, I see a picture of a thriving, reproducing church established in every people group of the world. On the wall of my office is a huge, it's almost the size of the wall, a huge map of the world. I can picture that map, or a map of the world in my mind right now, and I can picture on that map, on this world, congregations in every country, every region, every language, every people group of the world. Jesus said in Matthew 28, go and make disciples of all peoples. If I cooperate with God in the coming to pass of that vision picture of the future that God has painted, I can't fail. God has guaranteed it will happen, and I'm willing to invest my life to seeing that picture come to pass. How about you? Thirdly, I see Jesus coming again. I have a mental picture of that. I have a mental picture of Jesus with all of the accoutrements of power coming, breaking through the clouds and coming to this earth just as He said He would. I see Jesus coming and reigning as King of Kings and Lord of Lords, not just potentially, but actually, visibly, and eternally. And in that mental picture of the future, I see all of those believers who died before Jesus came being raised from their graves, and all of us who had not died when Jesus came and were trusting in Him gathered together and standing before the Lord Jesus Himself, knowing then as we never knew before that everything He said that would happen has happened. And I see us all with one accord saying following Jesus was worth it. It was worth every bit of it. Because then we shall see in actuality what we now see only in that God-given picture vision of the future. Those pictures of the future are what drive the present. Those pictures of the future are what determine how you act and what you do, how you live, the things you invest in, what's important to you. What's the picture? What is it you live your life for? Faith is being sure of what we hope for. Oh, it's being certain of what we do not see. Those who come to God must believe that He exists and that He rewards those who earnestly seek Him. Pray with me, please.